You are listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 21st of March 2024 on Monocle Radio. It is 2300 in Canberra, 1400 in Kigali, midday here in London and 9am in Rio de Janeiro. You're listening to Monocle Radio. The Briefing starts now. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Chris Chermak. Coming up on today's program, US Secretary of State Antony Blinken is back in the Middle East. We'll examine whether there's any progress towards a ceasefire in Gaza. After that...
The tragedy is, we know the Prime Minister doesn't even believe in the Rwanda gimmick.
UK opposition leader Keir Starmer strikes out at Prime Minister Rishi Sunak over his on-again, off-again plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda. We'll get the latest on a long-standing legislative fight over the policy and how it could impact the country's elections. And then...
As always with Finland, you know, we do like our own music in our own language, so it's going to be quite different probably to some of the other editions.
A special extended edition of the Global Countdown this week. Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke with our Helsinki correspondent, Petri Birdsoff. All that and the latest business headlines right here on The Briefing with me, Chris Chermak. We start today's show in the Middle East. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in the region for the sixth time since the October 7th attacks, currently in Cairo for talks with Arab officials. Talks of a ceasefire in Gaza are once again taking place as well, but hope for an actual breakthrough remains, well, pretty slim at this point, even as American patience with Israel appears to be wearing thin. Well, joining me now is Ruth Michelson, journalist and Middle East correspondent. And also on the line is Paul Rogers, Open Democracy's international security expert. Ruth, let me start with you. Antony Blinken was in Saudi Arabia yesterday to kick off this Middle East trip. What came out of that and what do you make of Saudi Arabia's role in general in all of this?
Well, we know that when Blinken was in Saudi, this seemed to be he treated it as an opportunity to kind of continue with the idea that there might be a potential peace deal between Saudi Arabia and Israel that the US has been pushing for some time. It completely, you know, in despite of everything that's happening on the ground in Gaza. You know, we know that there was some discussion of a ceasefire, and there was, you know, an attempt to essentially keep Saudi Arabia on side before Blinken heads to Tel Aviv for this surprise visit. But I mean, it really feels like you said it yourself. This is the sixth time that he's been in the region since the 7th of October. And it really feels like we're just seeing the US doing the same thing over and over again with very, very little change in the results, if not things actively getting worse.
Well, Paul, on that fact, I mean, Antony Blinken and the US have now, perhaps slight change, but they have made quite clear at this point that they are calling for an immediate ceasefire. Antony Blinken said that again yesterday in interviews as well. Do we imagine that's having any kind of effect?
I don't think so. I mean, the Israeli Minister of Strategic Affairs, Ron Dermer, went on record very recently saying that essentially Israel would go ahead with the attack on Rafah, and even if that caused a rift with the United States. I think the reality is that Biden is not in a position to, or not prepared to, go the full hog and tell the Israelis that the United States will withdraw military support. You're in the extraordinary position at the moment of the US Army having five logistics ships starting to work on this new port, and the Navy sending three large cargo vessels across the Atlantic to back that up. But at the same time, the United States is agreeing to further shipments of arms to Israel. So essentially, I think for domestic reasons and maybe personal reasons, we are still stuck with the position that Biden, well, to put it crudely, not pull the plug on the war, which he's able to do, I think, because the Israelis are now so dependent on the United States. But the US has to accept this, and essentially the Netanyahu government is really determined to go on with its original plan, even though that's proving very difficult. And in fact, Hamas is proving extremely difficult to dislodge, even from areas that the Israelis thought they'd got under control in Gaza. So we are stuck here with very little movement unless something changes on the American side.
Well, Ruth, I mean, Paul mentioned there that the U.S. might, despite its rhetoric, be willing to accept this. But Antony Blinken is in Cairo today, meeting with more foreign ministers from the Arabic region. Are they going to accept this? I mean, what do we imagine those kind of conversations are like for Antony Blinken at this point? How difficult is it to keep Arab nations on side here?
I think it's quite a challenge, given that there is this division between the fact that the US has, as you say, as we've seen that as Blinken's visits to the region have continued since the 7th of October, that there has been a shift in the rhetoric, that there is more talk about a ceasefire. But at the same time, that the weapon sales are continuing, that they are fueling these attacks that are happening with these weapon sales, and that the Biden administration has even, on a couple of occasions, bypassed congressional approval in order to keep the flow of those weapons going to the Israelis. And I think that contradiction is likely to be very present in the conversations that Blinken is having with people like Sameh Shoukry, the Egyptian foreign minister. And then there are also the concerns that you will find from the Egyptians and from others about the spillover of this war. The Egyptians are particularly concerned that an Israeli offensive into Rafah will push Gazans into the northern Sinai. And it feels as though the U.S. doesn't necessarily have a good answer for some of these problems, that they're trying to keep their allies in the region on side while not necessarily providing the same kind of support that we've seen the U.S. provide to Israel.
Paul, what do you make of this idea of trying to keep Arab leaders on side as well? I mean, you said there that the U.S. is the one that could potentially pull the plug on this war and is not doing so. Conversely, on the other side, Arab leaders have been vocal, but they haven't necessarily taken much action against Israel or really gotten sort of involved on the ground in this conflict. Is there a danger of some sort of escalation here, or are they still simply dedicated to trying to end this conflict?
As far as the Arab leaders are concerned, I'd agree very much with Ruth that essentially they really see this in perhaps rather different lights, because most of the Arab leaders are more than prepared to work with the Israelis. They deal with them fairly routinely now. But, and it's a huge but, their own populations may be taking a very different attitude. I know it's a crude term, but if you use the term the Arab street, public opinion in the Middle East and across much of the global south has moved very strongly against Israel because of the sheer loss of life. I mean, we're now talking about, I think it's now over 32,000 Palestinians killed and over 75,000 injured in the past 5.5 months. And that does not account for probably several thousand people who are missing under the rubble. And that is having a very big effect right across the Middle East and making the Arab leaderships in several countries really very uncomfortable about their own situation. And I think this is one of the reasons why they would like to see an end to this, and they will go part of the way to doing it, but they're not going to do anything which destabilizing things even more than it is at present. So again, we are stuck in a bind. The United States, for its own reasons, the Biden administration does not want to move the full way. But for the moment, I think we are in something of a stalemate, and all Blinken could do is try and keep some channels open and moderate things a bit. But Netanyahu is determined to take this path. He has the senior membership of the IDF behind him, even though he's not popular in the country as a whole. On the issue of doing, quote, something about Hamas, he still has majority popularity in the country.
That was Ruth Michelson and Paul Rogers. I'm sure we'll have more on Antony Blinken's visit as he heads to Israel next. Now here's Emma Searle with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Chris. Russia has launched a missile attack overnight on the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv, injuring at least 10 people. Officials say the attack damaged residential buildings and industrial facilities. It's the first large assault on the city for several weeks. Australia and the United Kingdom on Thursday signed a new defence and security cooperation agreement. The deal will make it easier for their defence forces to operate together in each other's countries. Meanwhile, Australian media have reported that a British company is expected to be named as the contractor to build a nuclear submarine under the AUKUS agreement. And finally, the presidential furniture row takes a new turn in Brazil. After President Lula da Silva initially accused his predecessor, Jair Bolsonaro, of taking 261 furniture items with him upon leaving office, the Brazilian government has now reported that dozens of them have been found. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Chris.
Thanks very much, Emma. What a crazy story from Brazil. We'll have more on that. But time for a news business roundup now here on Monocle Radio with Bloomberg's Ewan Potts, who joins us from Dubai. Ewan, let's start with interest rates, something we've already been discussing this week with the Bank of Japan's historic decision. But we also have a rate decision from the Bank of England.
Hello, Chris. Yes, the Bank of England has voted to leave interest rates at a 16-year high of 5.25%. It was widely expected by economists. The chair of the bank says that it's not yet time to cut rates. Last time, you'll remember that there was a three-way split at the Bank of England, something that's quite unusual. Some voting to cut, some to hike, and some to hold. Well, this time, the two members who voted for a rate rise last time have ditched that call. The vote was 8 to hold and 1 to cut. It's actually the first time since late September, so since September 2021, that no member of the panel has supported an increase. There's been plenty of central bank action this week, as you mentioned, keeping investors on their toes. Lots of speculation over when interest rates will finally begin their downward ascent, apart from Japan, of course, which is a very special case. Economists' best guess was that this week wouldn't be the week that we saw any rate cuts from the main central banks. But the cheeky Swiss have snuck in there with the first rate cut by a G10 economy in the world. They've cut their key interest rate by 25 basis points, a quarter of a percentage point, moving ahead of global peers as they try to prevent gains in the Swiss franc. The Swiss interest rate is now 1.5%. The Swiss National Bank also unveiling a lower forecast for inflation, saying that price gains will be no higher than 1.5%. Through to 2026. And yesterday, of course, we had the Federal Reserve, the world's most important central bank. They held rates as expected, but all eyes were really on the dot plot, the forecast of where rates are going to go over the next year. And that was left at the expectation there will be 3 rate cuts in the United States over the course of 2024. There were worries among investors that the Fed chair might sound a bit more hawkish this time. Inflation has been a little bit bumpy over the last few months in the US, and the labor market is red hot, but he didn't really sound particularly hawkish. And that really put further fuel on the stock market rally. The S&P 500 closing at another record high yesterday, and stocks making big gains in Europe today.
Interesting stuff, Ewan. I'm stuck on those cheeky Swiss, but let's move on for now to one other story. There's been a big investment by the United Arab Emirates in Egypt, which is, of course, facing a pretty massive economic crisis at the moment. What can you tell us?
Yeah, it certainly is. A story from where I am at the moment. The UAE swooped in last month to save Egypt's struggling economy with a $35 billion deal. And according to a Bloomberg source, the Emiratis are willing to invest a similar amount in a different African nation were a new opportunity to present itself. Now, if I asked you, Chris, to take a guess at the biggest foreign investors in Africa, you would probably say China, or maybe a second choice, you might say the United States. Well,
or maybe Russia.
Or perhaps Russia, indeed. Well, it may surprise you, and it did surprise me, that in 2022 and in 2023, the answer is, in fact, the United Arab Emirates. Last year, the UAE pledged $45 billion of foreign direct investment in the African continent. That topped China's $26 billion. China's infrastructure funding, which we've known about for many years in Africa, has been tapering off, and Western engagement has been wavering as well. Well, Abu Dhabi's cash flows are really stepping in. And they've been coupling this with a concerted diplomatic push. And it's something that's been mirrored to a lesser extent by neighbours in Saudi and in Qatar. The investments have been focused mainly in renewable energy, logistics, technology, real estate, and in agriculture. And the Emiratis have also been signing free trade deals on the continent of Africa as well. Morocco, South Africa, and Egypt have all signed up. And Kenya was added last month. So lots and lots of signs that Arab influence in Africa is here to stay for the long term.
Ewan Potts, thank you very much for joining us. Interesting story there at the end as well. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. You are back with the briefing on Monocle Radio. I'm Chris Chermak. It is deja vu all over again here in the UK over the country's plans to send asylum seekers to Rwanda. The House of Lords yesterday for a second time delayed the planned legislation by sending a series of changes to a version passed by the House of Commons. For those of you outside of the UK, this is about the only power the House of Lords here has. It can delay and make changes to bills, but unlike, say, the Senate in the US, it is not a co-equal legislative body. Well, for more on this, Terry Stiassny, the political journalist, author, and regular Monocle contributor, joins me here in the studio. Good afternoon, Terry.
Hi, Chris.
Let's, first of all, Terry, just remind us of what this controversial Rwanda bill involves.
Well, this bill came about because the government's original plans to send asylum seekers to Rwanda were found to be unlawful in some respects by the Supreme Court. So the government basically had to promise, if we say, we're going to bring in emergency legislation which overcomes the objections of the Supreme Court and allows these deportations to go ahead. And some of the objections were that asylum seekers, if they were sent to Rwanda, could end up being sent on to some other country rather than, you know, the place they originally came from, or sent back. So they deemed that this wasn't a safe thing to do. And as you say, there have been huge numbers of hurdles along the way. And these objections by the House of Lords is just the latest one for a scheme that the government wanted to have up and running by the spring.
And can you put this into context for us in terms of legislative fights? I mean, how rare is this kind of step from the House of Lords, kind of trying to assert some measure of authority?
It happens fairly often. What you don't quite so often get is what's known, it's called legislative ping pong. That's not the official name. The official name is consideration of Lords Amendments. But basically,
ping pong
is much better. And it actually, I'm not sure if it still does, but it used to consist of literally a clerk in sort of old fashioned dress walking between the two chambers with the bill bound up in pink ribbon and handing it over from one chamber to the other as they decide it. You know, it's really sort of antiquated procedure. But the point of it is that you have to have both houses of parliament agree on it. And if you can't ultimately agree on it, the government's legislation will usually fall. And in this case, you had not only Labour peers, but some Conservatives, for instance, Ken Clark, who's, of course, a former Chancellor, leading Conservative figure, and this, what are they called, the crossbenchers, so the independents who aren't members of any party, who are still saying, no, we don't like what the government is saying, particularly they're worried about Britain's compliance with international law. They're worried about whether this treaty between the UK and Rwanda will be effective. And, you know, they're worried about this idea that you can just declare Rwanda a safe country and make that so by writing it into a British law, which they say, well, you can't. You know, Rwanda is either a safe country or it isn't. And a British law has no effect either way.
I mean, those are pretty big worries when you put it like that. Do we imagine there is a version of this bill that the House of Lords might agree to, or might this be one of those rare cases where the House of Lords actually succeeds in completely torpedoing a bill wanted by the government?
Well, they've put this off now for a couple of weeks. They could have tried to force it through before the Easter recess. They've decided they're not going to do that. It seems likely that the House of Lords will compromise at some point, but it could be quite dramatic. I mean, when this has happened in the past, in sort of, for instance, in 2005 under the Labour government, they would sit all night. They would argue about these things all night and go back and forth until ultimately they could agree on something. And often it is issues to do with human rights, particularly because you've got a lot of lawyers in the House of Lords, a lot of people who are concerned to uphold the Constitution. But the risk for the government is that they're going into an election, stopping the small boats is something that Rishi Sunak has repeatedly said that he's going to do. If they look out today across the channel, there are hundreds of people still trying to cross the channel to Britain. And this would be a massive loss. The government cannot afford to lose this. So they've got to find some way to get the House of Lords to agree so that they can then potentially, you know, in their view, what they want to do is start the deportation flights. And you know, that's not going to be able to happen for at least several months now.
Well, Terry, when you mentioned the elections, I mean, I'm reminded of these fights that we've been speaking a lot on Monocle Radio about in the US about immigration as well, where there's also been a, you know, complete breakdown, frankly, in Congress over what to do about it. But I just wonder here, when you look at the Tories and what they are doing and their proposals on migration, I mean, how popular are they? Is this something that they see as whatever you want to say about the policy itself, an election winner, something that they are sort of pushing in that vein for ahead of the elections in the same way as Republicans are in the US? Or is there a different dynamic here? Does Rishi Sunak look kind of desperate and powerless rather than actually pushing something people want?
I think it is popular with a certain section of Conservative voters, people who voted Conservative in 2019 under Boris Johnson's leadership, and particularly in what they call here the red wall seats, which are former Labour seats that have more recently voted Conservative at the last election, the kind of voters that the Conservatives are worried about losing to the Reform Party, which is Nigel Farage is one of the big figures associated with them. The trouble is, it's not necessarily a big issue for other voters, particularly voters in the south of England. If you look at the main issues in polling, it's consistently the economy, the health service, and some other issues like crime. Immigration's not as big an issue for all the voters. And one of the most recent polls today literally has suggested that the Conservatives among all voters are currently polling at 19% and Labour on 44%. You know, this fact falling below 20%, OK, it's only one poll, but the Conservatives are a good 25 points behind Labour at this point. So, you know, they are really worried.
Well, just finally on that then, if immigration is not the big topic as it is maybe in the United States, do we imagine then that Rishi Sunak is almost regretting this? Is this just something that at this point is a kind of ballast around him that he can't get rid of?
I think people think that there is an issue that needs to be solved. You know, the small boat crossings are obviously dangerous and unsafe for lots of people. And if you look at what Labour is saying about that, they agree that there is an issue to deal with here, but they just don't think that the Rwanda plan, which is costing a lot of money and involving a lot of political time, is the way to go about it. So they need to move on this in some way. But the question is, it just seems to be, you know, a fiasco that is going on and costing the government political capital.
Terry Stiassny, thank you very much for joining us. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. And finally, on today's show, I'm quite jealous I was not a part of this, but our senior correspondent and musical curator, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, was stolen away by our Helsinki correspondent, Petri Bertsoff, on a recent visit to Midori House. This was all Petri's idea, I can tell you. He clearly has a lot to say about Finnish music. And so without further ado, take it away, Fernando.
Hello, it is time for the Global Countdown, but this week is a very special one. Well, I have here in the studio Petri Bertsoff, our correspondent in Helsinki. Hello, Petri, how are you?
Hi, Fernando. I'm really happy to be doing the Global Countdown with you, and we can listen to some of the most popular music in the Finnish charts today. And as always with Finland, you know, we do like our own music in our own language, so it's going to be quite different probably to some of the other editions.
That's what I want to talk to you briefly, because every time I do Finland here on the Global Countdown, it's quite rare that there's an artist that is not from Finland in the top five. Because, you know, of course, it makes it more fun job for me. But it's very... So the Finns, they do love their own artist, right?
Yeah, and I think it has something to do with being a minority language, that, you know, we know that the language we need to sort of uphold and listen to music in our own language, because otherwise the language is going to disappear. And I think that's something that maybe in English-speaking countries you don't have the same sort of responsibility that you feel for your own culture. I think that's one of the reasons behind the popularity of Finnish music.
Listen, I'm a little bit nervous as well, because I might have to introduce some of the tracks. And if I mispronounce anything, just correct me. There's not a problem. It's a difficult language, Petri.
It is. It's a difficult language, yes. And I'd be happy to translate some of the lyrics for you. So I think we should go. So let's start with number five. What do we have?
We have Kledos and Etta with Katomata Takas. Let's have a listen. Tieto lisää tuskaa, mut tuska lisää tietoa, et jos on jotain plussaa, niin ehkä tän on tarkoitus mennä niin. Ehkä tää on kummalkin parhaaksi, levitä sun siivet ja lennät niin, niin se kattaa. It feels very emotional to me, Petri. There's some touches of hip-hop there, but it's kind of a ballad, right? Beautiful track.
Yeah, it is. And Katsomatta Takas basically translates as without looking back. And he was saying that without looking back, maybe it was meant to be this way. You spread your wings and you fly away. So I sense that there's maybe some melancholy here as well. But yeah, it's and also I know the music video for this is black and white and is shot on this beautiful beach. So I think there's a yeah, there's definitely maybe some backstory here.
Well, talking about emotions as well, our next track is called My Weakness, or, well, I wonder if Google Translate did a good job. It's called Hekutemi or something like that. It's by Yori and Spoppa. Let's have a listen and then you tell me what you think of this track. Siksi mun tunteet ollu jäässä. Tuli kaiken pilaemmessa sua pois mun päästä. Suoma just aattelin alan pikkuhiljaa tajuut mun heikkouteni silleen. Okei, kasvot kuin enkelillä lampi. Great production values, I have to say. I mean, it's a good beat there.
Yeah, it is a good beat. And Heiko then he exactly translates as my weakness. And,
good.
And they're singing it actually to a girl saying that I finally realized that you are my weakness and I'm thinking of your face. So in a way, this is it's a love song. And, you know, Finns are not maybe known as the most romantic people, but we can be romantic as well sometimes.
And the hip-hop scene in Finland is quite strong, right?
Yes, hip-hop and R&B is really, really big at the moment. Most of the stuff in the charge is actually hip-hop and R&B. And it's quite interesting. I mean, I'm a 90s kid myself. I was a teenager in the 90s, and that was the time when the Finnish hip-hop was sort of the scene was born. And I remember some of the first acts, and I would listen to them as well. And, you know, now still some of the most famous rap artists in Finland are from the 90s. And then they're like my age, you know, 40-something and still
hip-hop
singing.
Hip-hop for all ages, you know?
exactly. But yeah, it's, you know, Finnish hip-hop is like easygoing. A lot of it is just like feel-good kind of hip-hop. Not very aggressive hip-hop. I like it.
Talking about feel-good, I was reading about our next artist. He's been described as the shining star of Finnish Afrotrap. Love it. I mean, and this song that we're gonna hear it, I think it's one of my favorites so far. It's by Ege Zulo and Ben. The song's called, again, Tunista Tenten. Let's have a listen. You know what, Petri? I made a decision right now. I will include this track on the Monocle playlist. It's great.
This is an amazing track. This is I've heard this one before. Actually, this has been in the charts for some time because I recognize this. And yes, Ege Zulu is an up and coming. It's really one of the big names. There's a lot of buzz around him, and Bem as well, who features on this track. She's super famous as well. Tunnista Tuntin, from Hour to Hour. And this, you know, listen to lyrics again. This was another love song. So maybe it's a theme. Maybe it's not only you Brazilians and the Mediterranean. Maybe it's the Finns who are the romantics here.
I agree.
We just need music to be able to express our opinion.
Well, and one thing I have to say, Petri, from all the Finns I know, I've met a few, they're all so friendly as well. I mean, some people say, oh, the Finns can be serious. I don't think so.
Yeah. And easy. I mean, all the tracks that we've listened to so far, they're like feel good and easy going tracks. Like quite pleasant to listen to, I have to say. Because, I mean, that's also one thing, that we have this reputation of being this like heavy metal, you know, like quite hardcore music lovers, and that's definitely also true, but it's still relatively marginal. Not everybody listens to, I don't think I know anybody that listens to heavy metal, so it's still kind of fringe, and I don't like the stereotype of all Finns being heavy metal lovers.
I agree. Let's go to number two. Number two is a bit of a mystery. There's not much about them online, but, you know, I want to hear your opinion. It's Tupe and Vepo with Ellie. I'm gonna come across as very old here, Petri, but this is the kind of song that we are hearing more and more, this kind of speed up versions. I don't know exactly the name, but yeah, they look very young. I was wondering even if they were brothers,
yeah,
but I was not sure.
Yeah, Ellie and Vepo, they're young. They look like they're like maximum 15.
Yes.
And look like brothers, and I don't know much about, but just listening to the lyrics, actually quite sad now that I heard the lyrics. It's about Ellie is the name of the girl, and she's, I don't know, she's contemplating on harming herself because they're saying like, don't do it. And I just read something about this. I read about the comments as well for this video, and it's basically
about young women's, young girls' mental health also, and just sort of speaking up against that. So quite an important song that, you know, young artists are singing about themes like that. I think it's a nice thing that this happens.
I'm so glad you're here to tell me what the lyrics are all about. But number one, I think it's kind of a favorite of ours. It's a really cool song, and perhaps she might be Finland's biggest pop star. Let's have a listen. It's the great Mirella with Timante. So good. This is my vibe. Great electropop. Love it. Is Mirella big in Finland?
She is huge. Mm. And she sort of came out of nowhere. She's only 18.
Wow.
And she belongs to the Swedish-speaking minority. There's a couple of 100,000 of them living in Finland. So Swedish is her native language. You can hear, I mean, I'm just reading, there's a Helsingin Sanomat, Finland's main daily, did a long feature on her just a couple of days ago. And basically she grew up, her father is a musician, and she's been sort of brought up with instruments and playing the piano, and has quite of a classical training as well. And she sort of, as many Finno-Swedes do, sort of they get their cultural references from Sweden. So she's, you know, grown up listening to Robin and the Swedish sort of electropop, and you can hear those influences. It's a really feel-good track, translates as diamonds. And it's Finno-Swedes have this reputation of being very optimistic and happy people, and most of their songs are like that. And Mirella, actually, they're sort of the Swedish-speaking minority, their main music competition for children is this Melody Grand Prix. And she, Mirella, won it when she was 15, three years ago, and now and sort of shot into fame as a result of that.
Well, I'll definitely keep an eye on Mirella. And you know what? I'll be adding this one to the playlist as well. So it's been a very useful global countdown.
Excellent.
How do I say thank you in Finnish again?
Kiitos.
Kiitos.
Gitas. That was Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Monocle's Helsinki correspondent Petri Birdsoft. The Global Countdown will be back in its usual format next Thursday. And that's all the time we have for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Paige Reynolds, researched by George Ruskin, and our studio manager was Lily Austin. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. I'm Chris Chermak. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.